In Chinese and Japanese Buddhism, they have these temples, and temples have Buddhist, all kinds of Buddhist statues, different kinds. And they have statues of Buddhas, different kinds of Buddhas, not just Shakyamuni Buddha. And the Buddhas are always presented in a Chinese fashion, I would imagine, in very idealistic mode. Just wonderfully perfect or great or powerful, radiant beings who have no wrinkles. Never old. And but then sometimes they'll have accompanying statues, always smaller, of the disciples of the Buddha, the arhats, the fully enlightened disciples, of people who were literally, you know, living disciples of the Buddha. Lohans in Chinese. And they are far from ideal. Or maybe they're idealistic, but they're in the opposite way. They're completely human. A lot of them are wrinkled, they're old, they're bent over. They have all this expressions in their face. The Buddhas are all serene and equanimous, and they've chilled out. But these arhats, these enlightened disciples of the Buddha, I mean, they have all this emotions in their face, and, you know, some of them seem like they're maybe angry, some of them seem like they're grieving and sad, some of them, it's just like all, you know, human life is there. So on one hand you have this ideal, and the other you have the human manifestation, and the humanity. And the humanity, these Chinese statues, it's a full humanity kind of expressivity and emotion and all that. And but they're also enlightened. These arhats are enlightened. So it's easy in Buddhism to have something like the Buddha up on a pedestal and to think that, you know, you're supposed to chill like him and just kind of never get a wrinkle and never have any difficult emotions ever again, and better if you don't show any emotions except for a little half smile. and you'd have good posture too. You just to be able to fit into this image of perfection, or image of, you know, this, you know, the really good Buddhist. It's easy to have that kind of idea, and then in the process of that, losing our humanity, the humanness of who we are. And I like these Chinese custom of having both statues sometimes in the temple, and reminding us of the human side of it. And last I checked, all of us here are humans, and so we have to find a human way of being in this world. We have to kind of contend and come to terms with and with our humanness, and it's wonderful to be a human, and it's very difficult. I don't know. This is just a little gillism. You probably forgive me a little bit of having gillisms, but my little gillism is that don't take it too seriously, but. I tell this to people who are of a certain age. I say, by the time you're 50, your life has been a success. Just to get to 50, that's all you have to do. Just get to 50, and you know, that's quite an accomplishment. You know, I bow to you for getting that far, because I think life is difficult. It's a lot of challenges, and challenges growing up, challenges after growing up. And so we're trying to find our way in this human realm, and sometimes people will not want to meet their humanness, not want to really be present for the fullness of their hearts and minds and who they are. And sometimes to idealism of one form or other. And Buddhism has its temptations. It's very, you know, to, you know, have these, like these Buddha, you know, these Buddhas that, and these wonderful ideals of great compassion and great peace and equanimity and all, you know, and infinite wisdom and no wrinkles and all these things. And so it's, you know, so some people try to escape into that ideals. They try to live up to that. They think that they're only successful if not good enough to be 50. They're not good enough to be 20. It's only good enough if you can become somehow the ideal Buddhist, the perfected Buddhist, enlightened Buddhist or something, whatever that you think that might be. And, but I think, you know, I think a really wise approach to practice is to learn to be human, to really enter into the human realm and learn how to have certain kind of freedom in it, certain kind of peace or ease or well-being in the midst of this world where we experience the whole range of human life and emotions and challenges and tragedies and joys and losses and gains. And it's, you know, all this stuff goes on. So how do we meet this world? How do we live in our humanness with grace? How do we live in humanness with graciousness, with peace, with ease? I think is my reading is kind of the task of Buddhist practice. And so one of the approaches to this is to, that I think is very wise, is not to leave the human realm behind, but rather to step into it. Be in the middle of it, but maybe in certain conditions. So like, I would like to believe that our coming here, we're retreating from the world, we're not retreating from being human. This is a place hopefully we can meet ourselves and discover our humanity in a new way, deeper way. Because it's all too easy out there, that real world, to not be very human. Have you noticed? Or, you know, it's not often not the best of people that gets written about in the newspapers. You know, the newspapers don't have headlines and say, someone attained complete ease with their full humanity today. Today. Flash. Pictures of that person and... Wow. But if you shoot someone, you know, nowadays, then you get your picture on the paper. But, you know, all the people who didn't shoot someone, they don't get any credit for that. I read this great quote this week. I don't think I told you. I told someone. It said, only God gives you credit for the angry words you don't speak. And or maybe the Buddhists would say, only your karma gives you credit for all the angry actions you avoided doing. Because, you know, you didn't do it, no one else sees it, that you didn't do it, but your karma knows, your heart knows, you know, it actually has a big impact there. So we retreat from a world where it's easy to lose touch with ourselves, easy to kind of not be so human in certain kinds of ways. And I hope to come here to really be who we are, to become human. And it's not easy to do this. In my early retreats that I sat, I suffered a lot. And little bit I was not so smart, and little bit I didn't know much about Buddhism, and so I was kind of lucky to not know so much, and hadn't read many books. I didn't know much about what could happen in meditation. But I was practicing Zen, where the practice that I was taught was a kind of an unconditional acceptance of the present moment. So I didn't even know I was supposed to stop thinking in meditation. I just was practicing unconditional acceptance. And or unconditional just being with what was, and what was a lot of suffering for me. And so, but you know, I didn't know any better or didn't know any different. I just had a lot of faith in just the practice and doing it. And so I just kept showing up and suffering better. Suffering more fully or something, but what worked was just being really present for it. So this idea we've been talking about, vitakka and vichara, as the two elements of being really present for something. So I stayed present. I'd come back to my mind, wouldn't draw off, and I'd come back to the present moment, and lo and behold, I was still suffering. So I would just sit there with that. And in that process, I did not become enlightened, sitting with all that suffering. But maybe something more important happened. Without any intention, without even knowing it was an issue or whatever, I became compassionate. That somehow just sitting there and registering, taking in, being present in an accepting way without fighting and without self-criticism, without feeling bad about myself, just being with it, something began to soften and thaw and open up. Back in the old days, I likened it to tenderizer, like you put tenderizer on meat to make it soft. So the practice was the tenderizer from my heart, my tough heart. So this idea of just sitting there, and so I think that a huge task for this practice of ours is to learn to meet ourselves and to have certain kind of willingness to have a certain kind of acceptance of who we are and what's going on, a certain kind of willingness to not be in conflict, not to judge, not criticize, not conclude that it's bad or wrong, not be in a hurry to fix because we have to become like the Buddha with no wrinkles. We just have to just be and meet ourselves and kind of take stock and really discover who we are as a human being. Every human being is different, and every human being is similar in all kinds of ways. In this wonderful world where we share so much in common, and we have all these wonderful differences, and that's also a very painful world. Sometimes it's painful how similar we are. Sometimes it's painful because we do make a lot about our differences. But we have to somehow, we have to meet ourselves as we are and allow for our way we're different, allow for how we're the same, just allow for our uniqueness for who we are. Some of you know Jack Kornfield's book. I think it was in some of his books. He has this theory that after visiting a lot of people who have quite mature in their spiritual life, practicing for 30, 40, 50 years, one of his conclusions was that the more mature someone becomes spiritually, the more eccentric they become. Are you ready for that? More quirky. And how I understand that is you become more yourself. You become less... less you're kind of artificially conformed to society and the norms and what family and everyone wants you to be and what a good person, and you're more willing just to kind of be yourself, which maybe is a little bit quirky. And I think quirkiness is underrated in our society. We'd probably be a happier society if more of us were quirky. Meaning just being ourselves. So, a huge part of the practice is meeting ourselves and making space for it, having space in the heart, having space in the mind, having space in our hands, it's okay, this is how it is right now, this is who I am, this is what's going on. And it can take a long time to learn the skill, the art of not being reactive to what we see, not closing down, not judging what's going on, not trying to make it different than what it is, or not, it's a whole art to learn not to make much ado about it, not to interpret it and make big conclusions, that, any kind of conclusion, like, wow, this means that I will never or always and always be this way, or never be that way, but just to be very simple, just allow ourselves to be human in the most simple and direct and easy way as possible. This is who I am. 10 years ago or so, I was at a meeting of the most senior teachers from the San Francisco Zen Center. These are people who have been practicing by that time, I think it probably between 30 and 40 years of practice they've been doing. And the question that was asked in the circle of us sitting there was, well, what have you, what, how have you benefited from your years of Zen practice? So that'd be interesting, you know, like, wow, you could hear the inside story, what these people have to say. And as they went around, what the common theme that was really clear was, said all kinds of things, but the most common theme was these was a group of people who had been, were completely accepting for who they were, completely accepting of their unique foibles and quirkiness and challenges and wrinkles and all these things. They just, you know, that was part of the fruit of all these years of practice. They just be themselves. And they were unapologetically themselves or undefendedly themselves. And I kind of expected a little bit that they were going to be, you know, trying to paint a good picture of themselves as good Zen students. But no, they just, you know, there was this beautiful quality of holding their humanity with grace and openness and honesty. That was part of it. So that's a task, a beautiful task, and a great task, a noble task to do. And it certainly alleviates a lot of suffering to do that. So we have this practice of practices of meditation that is meant to support that process. And one way of thinking of meditation, defining meditation in Buddhism, is it's the act of meeting yourself, learning how to meet yourself, learning how to meet yourself with generosity, and learn how to meet your experience with ease and non-reactivity, and just kind of meet yourself, find what's here, make space for what's here. To support that, so that there's some stability and some steadiness as we meet ourselves, and we have practices that focus on creating stability. So concentration practices are practices of that create stability. One of the important purposes of concentration practices is to create a, it would be likened to if you have a telescope and you hold a big telescope, you hold it in your hand, you're trying to look at the moon or a star, you probably can't see it because you can't hold the telescope still enough in your hands. But if you put the telescope on a tripod, then it's stable and it doesn't wobble so much, and you can see some object far in the distance. So the same way with our minds, if the mind is agitated and wobbly, you can't really see deeply into yourself, see what's really going on. You can't hold this steady enough gaze to really understand. And so the stilling quality or of concentration practice, this stabilizing, is to create the tripod so that our ability to see sees well, really sees what's there. That's probably the most important Buddhist purpose of concentration practice. It has other purposes as well, to develop concentration. And another purpose is that in order to get concentrated, in order to have this stability, there has to be a lot of letting go. And letting go is probably the most relaxing and letting go, relaxing and letting go. You can't get concentrated in a tense way. And so you can, a certain kind of concentration, but it's not the samadhi concentration that's soft and malleable and comfortable. And so there has to be, so part of the purpose of concentration practice is to create stability. The other purpose is to create a feeling of joy, of well-being. Because with you can't really see yourself, you can't meet yourself as a full human being if you see yourself through the eyes of grimness. I can't tell you how many times me and people I've known have tried to get mindful, get concentrated, get enlightened through grimness. And I don't know anybody who's managed that. I don't think it's possible. You know, too serious, got to do this, and bear down, and you know, and being grim and serious, and then the other people are not serious enough, and you, if you're in some schools of Zen, you know, and you're given the authority, you go around and make sure everyone else is grim enough, sit up straight, they even come around with a stick and whack you if you're not grim enough. So, but grimness doesn't work. So well-being does, having a sense of joy and happiness. And at the time of the Buddha was known among people of the time as the happy one, the person who was happy. And people commented about how the Buddhist monks and nuns around the Buddha were happy, happy people. They were not ascetics. They weren't people who were denying their humanity, denying themselves and torturing themselves, but they were at ease and had a certain joy and happiness. And so concentration practice is part of that joy. It comes from letting go, comes from simplification, comes from relaxing. And that joy is a very powerful condition. It's a very powerful effect. It's a very good, amazing teacher to have well-being. I like the word well-being because it's vague enough to include a whole range of things. Joy seems too limited. And so we're looking for well-being in this practice. Maybe not soon, maybe it won't be this year, but that's the direction we're going. We're not going to try to become grimmer and more serious, but lighter and happier as we do it. The joy makes it a lot easier to let go. The joy makes it a lot easier to overcome some of the addictions and attachments we have. Because we can, with the joy as a reference point, the well-being as a reference point, we can feel how the attachments, the clinging we have, the addictions we have, are not as much fun. They don't feel as good. You know, if you can let go of the addiction, you have this better thing waiting for you. You have this well-being. So if you're going to let go of things, but you don't know that what you let go into, the alternative is available in a nice way, why would you let go? You know, you still believe that somehow that hope against all hope that yes, one more bottle of wine will do it. It hasn't worked yet, but you don't have anything else. You might as well. But if you know something else, then there's a lot of things you can let go of, a lot of things you can mature and grow out of if you know something. So part of the purpose of Buddhist practice is to cultivate well-being. And that's done many ways. And probably one of the best ways is to do it not direct attack on well-being, but rather to set in place the conditions that support ease and well-being. So living by the ethical precepts is classically done in order to create a sense of well-being, to feel good about yourself, to do practices like generosity, to serve other people, help other people out, do a variety of things the kind of things that can help you feel good, feel happy. If you have something you know that you really like doing, that really nourishes you and brings you joy or a sense of well-being, and give time doing that. Nourish yourself. It's okay. I know people who, because of their religious background perhaps and other family backgrounds and stuff, where they've gotten the message that to do the things that make them feel good and whole and nourishing, that's selfish. You know, you shouldn't do that. You have to sacrifice yourself in order to help everyone else. And some families, it's really important to worry, because worry is the currency of caring. You only show that you love people in the family if you worry well. And if you don't worry, then how are they going to know you love them? You know, so, but worry is not a good recipe for well-being and happiness. So to learn to do what nourishes you and makes you feel good and happy, that's kind of like the conditions that you want to set in place. So what are the conditions that support your well-being, help you feel a little more happier, and move you in that direction? Grimness doesn't work. And sometimes in order to do the things that help you feel happy or have a sense of well-being, it takes a lot of courage, because maybe it's not what your family or society thinks is what you should do. And so what do you do, you know, and feels insecure, you know. But that's part of the negotiation, finding our way in this difficult human world, is to find how to manage with all the different competing messages and ideas. It's not a mistake, it's this way, it's just how it is, and we work with it. And then, so part of the function of concentration practice is to create well-being. The other thing is that concentration practice is also creates conditions for healing, as Max said yesterday. There's something about the unification, the integration, and not being fragmented, that helps everything kind of flow together. The nerves, the blood, whatever. And actually, when you get really still and quiet, connected in a unified way, many people report that it just feels like there's healing energy kind of coursing through their arms and their legs and their body. It's quite something. It just rises up on its own. It doesn't have to, you can't make it happen. But it's very healing, and people who carry a lot of suffering and pain and wounds and psychological wounds, it's remarkable how healing concentration practice can be if you let it kind of, if you relax into it, let it register it and receive it. And all this stuff, learning to let go, well-being, seeing clearly what's going on, healing. One of the functions of concentration practice is to help us overcome selfishness. Because selfishness is a way of not being whole. Selfishness is a way of being contracted and tight. You're not really human in a full way if you're selfish, because it leaves things out. You can't fully be, you're not fully here if you're selfish. So this movement to release and let go of self-centeredness is part of one of the things that concentration practice helps support, because you feel something that feels so much better than being selfish. Imagine yourself, you know, sitting as peacefully and concentratedly as you maybe have ever felt in your life, a wonderful sense of well-being, and finally you can feel like you're safe and you can relax, and it's so nice. You're sitting under an oak tree and it's such a beautiful day, and it's just so nice and wonderful and peaceful, and and you're not sleepy because you had a good nap, so you're completely awake and clear, and your heart is settled on itself. And then some person walks by, and you jump up to them and say, "Look at me, I'm a really good tree sitter. I'm like the best person who's ever been relaxed in the world, and I'm just really going to show you how relaxed I am, and I'm really special." You know, it's like, what? What did you lose? You know, why? You know, you just realize, you know, you had this one, you lost it. It's like they say, you know, certain, you know. So it helps overcome selfishness as well. So vitakka and vichara, this being present for yourself, two elements of being present. It's an act of generosity to offer presence. So these are the two elements of it, is to show up and then stay present. That's basically it. Show up and stay present for what's going on. Hang out. Take time to get to know it, to be with it. It doesn't have to be for long. I like to think that you can have brief samadhis, instantaneous samadhis. You know, one of the ways to suffer is to think that your samadhi has to be continuous. Like, I got to be in the zone and just, you know, the whole sitting, the whole day, and you can barely remember to notice your next breath. So you're like, oh, it's such a big disparity between what you want to do and what's actually happening. But brief samadhi might be that you're able to connect and stay with half a breath. And if that's your goal, I'm going to try to be with half a breath. Then you don't have to get discouraged so much, because maybe you can do half a breath. And you can go, great, wow, I accomplished something today. Let's see if I can do that again, and again, and again, and again. Just half a breath. And I've known people who found that extremely helpful. And it kind of broke a tremendous suffering around getting concentrated and not feeling they can get concentrated. And they finally get concentrated when they gave up trying to have this in the zone, long concentration. And they just did this brief concentrations again and again. They could do that. So connecting and then sustaining for a while, half a breath, two breaths. And sometimes when you kind of get the hang of it, at least for me, in my quirkiness, for me it feels a little bit like surfing. And you paddle, and you to get, you know, some speed with the wave, and then the wave picks you up, and then you catch the wave, or it catches you, and then for a few moments, you know, you're sailing along, you're surfing along, and it feels so good. There's something, I don't know why it is, surfing feels so good. Last year it was raining, and I was visiting a friend, and I was leaving, and she said, "Oh, you have to go look at this bird in the neighborhood." And there was a bird in her neighborhood across the street. There was a car across the street, so there was, you know, it was raining, so the windshield was all wet. And this little bird would go and stand at the top of the windshield in the roof of the car, the edge, and then slide down. And then go back up again and slide down. Up again and slide down. The bird knew about, you know, brief samadhi. You know, so to catch the wave, or, you know, kind of to catch the samadhi, you know, for a moment, you have to just be there. And a little bit, it might be some, a little bit of a choice, like, let me just let go, let me just give myself into this, let me like, savor this for a moment. I can't do it for long, but let me hang in there with this experience. And so it's so a number of things happen as we gather ourselves together, or we kind of stay with the present moment more and more often, and is that slowly, the forces of distraction abate. We have this tremendous momentum, tremendous power in our concerns and fears and worries and plans and memories and all these stuff. There's a lot of energy that goes into it. But as we stop, and when we give it unfettered energy to keep thinking those things, it actually keeps it going, often fuels it. But if we stop fueling it by letting the energy of attention go into like the breath or into the present moment, then the energy, the food for our distractions begins to abate, begins to not be there. And slowly the distractions kind of fade away. And I suspect that, most of you would feel not as caught up in your thoughts as you did the first day. You probably still plenty of times caught up, but probably they're not so pulled as much anymore. And then as you get more into it and more present, then the next two jhanic factors, the next two factors of this kind of absorption, or factors of really being present for something, are factors of well-being. And the tradition calls it in Pali, piti and sukha. And piti translates, usually people translate into English as joy, and sukha, a variety of ways people translate it, but I prefer just happiness or well-being. Some people do pleasure, contentment, satisfaction, and so part of this process of really being wholeheartedly connected, wholeheartedly involved with what you're doing, has something about that it brings forth a certain kind of well-being. And part of it is that a lot of the lack of well-being, the way we feel bad, has to be, we're not inherently bad. We're not inherently feel lousy and terrible. There's activities of our mind. There's inner conflicts and fears and angers and clingings and disappointments that we have to kind of be involved in to feel bad. And if less and less of our energy goes into those things, and more those kind of abate, at least temporarily, then we're going to feel less and less bad. That's partly why people like to get distracted, is that they feel bad, and so they get a really good distraction. They don't think about what's going on. So a little bit, we're not exactly distracting ourselves, but a little bit we're not feeding all the things that make us feel bad. And so it tends then, with all those things abate, then it tends to be a little bit more sense of aliveness and presence and fullness and sense of goodness or presence that feels good, it feels nice, it's something. And it's good to start recognizing this. And this took me a long time to appreciate in my Buddhist practice, because I was a little bit of the grim school, you know, and also in Zen, it's like just, you know, you just cut right to emptiness, right to enlightenment, you know, just to the truth there. Just cut right there. None of this kind of wishy-washy stuff. you know, nothing sweet and saccharine, and you know, nothing joyful, heaven forbid, because you want to go just the truth, just but slowly what I came to learn is that a sense of well-being is very supportive for finding the truth, very supportive for this process of becoming human in a way that become free. And so it's good to begin to recognize the value of well-being and happiness, and to start recognizing when it arises. And there are simple things sometimes you can do to kind of encourage it to be there. You don't want to overdo it. You don't want to think, I'm supposed to be joyful and artificially make yourself happy. Or I've known people who've made it an enterprise to be happy and joyful, and I'd rather not be around them. You know, just so within reason, right? But it is a good thing, you know. So in meditations, in Buddhist meditation, one of the forms of delight or gladness or joy that it's said it's helpful to recognize and appreciate, and it maybe takes a little bit of reflection to have this joy, and that is that you've been meditating for some time and your mind has been distracted a lot, and then at some point you find, for who knows why, you're not distracted anymore. You have all these concerns, and those concerns faded away, and you find yourself just here. And to feel some delight that you're no longer having to contend with all this distracting mind, to feel some joy that now you're here. That's the first entry. It's called the joy of not being caught up in the hindrances. And Max will talk about the hindrances tomorrow. But to no longer kind of be caught up in the hindrances, no longer have them, no longer have your mind in charge. But you're in charge, kind of. Like, you know, if you're not your mind, who are you? But, you know, if your mind is, if your attention is held hostage by all the vagaries of your thoughts and desires and fears, and, you know, you don't have any control of where your attention goes, that doesn't feel good. But if you, all this is settled away enough that you feel like you have some presence and control and ability, mastery of your attention, you're here, it's clear, that can be a source of happiness, of joy. But it takes a little bit of reflection. So to recognize that, to know that. But the reason to do that is the tradition says that simple joy is a doorway into encourage you to stay more present. Then you want to be here. You want to be present. You want to stay there in that space if it feels good. So joy is an incentive to continue on the path. And then as you continue and you're in here, then the vitakka and the vichara, the supplying, sustaining, the brief samadhis, I think of it as, or the tradition actually talks about it a little bit like massaging. The tradition talks about kneading, like it's kind of a little bit like the analogy of kneading water into flour and kneading into a dough. You have to kind of knead it, massage it. And so the vitakka is more like reaching in to pushing, and maybe the vichara is more like letting go and being there with it and letting it do its thing. Come in. And so there's kind of a little bit of work to kind of stay there, come back, be here, be with the breath, feel the breath, be with the breath, feel the breath, be with the breath, ride the breath, be with the breath, let go with the breath. Kind of just, there's these two qualities. You show up for the breath and then surf the breath. Be with the breath and let the breath, the breathing wash over your body. Be with, you know, just give massage. It's kind of like do these things. And as you kind of, whatever you used to get more and more into the present moment, I like the expression wholeheartedly, just this. You wholeheartedly giving yourself over to just this activity, this wholeheartedness. Then, at some point, because it's wholehearted, and you're not distracted, you know, all these other kinds of concerns and worries that you have abated for a while, then there starts welling up a sense of goodness, sense of rightness, sense of happiness, sense of joy. And the expression is more like welling up. The ancient tradition likens it to a lake that has a underwater spring, refreshing spring that's welling up from the base of the lake and filling the lake with water. So there's something that gets born from the inside, a sense of well-being. And what's very significant about this inner well-being is it is like a spring that wells up from inside. It's not a well-being or happiness or joy that's dependent on winning the lottery or getting the date with your most perfect date partner, or you know, or getting a nice house or a car or more shoes or whatever. You know, it's not about things, not about getting things in the world. It's not dependent on the world. It's really all something that arises, that's how you are settled inside. So, and sometimes when that sense of energy wells up and is strong, people describe it as a thrill. And when this thrill gets really strong, it's sometimes described as rapture. And I liken it, so if vitakka and vichara, this initial and sustained attention, I liken it to petting a cat. So you have to make contact with a cat to pet it, right? So the making contact with a cat is vitakka. Petting the cat is vichara. The joy is the cat purring. So you as you do this and stay with it, at some point you start purring. Isn't that nice? And it's not something you can exactly, when you really purr, it's not something you can make happen, but it's like what? And some people are quite surprised. What? You know, what's going on here? I have no reason to be happy. I'm feeling joyful, but, there's a variety of symptoms. People feel very light sometimes. Sometimes there's the sense of body changes and sense of body boundaries fall away, or tingling in the body can happen sometimes, or warmth, different places in the body can happen, or sense of pleasure can happen. Sometimes the visual field becomes filled with light, or sometimes with color, as if we kind of, this kind of, purring takes different shapes, different forms. And so it's good to feel this, it's good to have it, but you have to take care of it, you have to nourish yourself, you have to kind of stay close. That's why on retreat, the idea is to be as simple as you can. Don't do a lot of things. It's best not to read. It's best not to be in social conversations. It's best not to do a lot of things that kind of pull you out of yourself. Like people who do like a lot of running, they feel really good by running. It gives them a vitality and they feel great and alive. And what's so, it's so great to be alive and present and after a good run. And they come on retreat and so they want to continue their running because they feel so alive and so good. But what happens if you go long enough retreats is that, yes, the running feels really good, but when you come back to meditate after running, the mind is so much more agitated, so much more spinning than it was before, and you have a lot of work to do to get back to the calm state you had before. So you want to kind of stay in a place that keeps you close in and quiet and not agitated, not kind of worked up. So you have a chance to let this kind of relax into your body. Let the body kind of begin to kind of feel settled and at home and alive. Enjoy your aliveness in your body so this well-being, this joy can be there. Sometimes, as I said, the thrill becomes quite strong. And so it can happen for a while. But it comes together with something that's more subtle and sometimes missed. And it comes together with what's the tradition called sukha. And sukha is, I like the word happiness for it, but it's a physical sense of sublime well-being or pleasure. Physical kind of, it's much more, it's a deep contentment, deep, deep satisfaction that's in, like in the pores or in the marrow of your body. And so at some point, as we get more present and quieter, stiller, the joy fades away. In fact, at some point, people get tired of the joy. Imagine that. I finally have joy, and now you're telling me. And I was on retreat once, and I knew there were better things to experience than joy. So I tried to avoid the joy, this welling up of joy. It's like I held it at bay. Like, I'm not going to have that because there's better things. Better things than that. I was doing walking meditation, IMS, and like, I'm not going to do that because I know this, you know, this, like, this joy is kind of like, that's not really so deep, you know. And so, but it you know, that's not a good strategy to, you know, to resist. So finally I could, you know, I don't know if I was getting a headache, I don't know what was going on, but so finally I said, oh, enough, you know, I can't, I let go. And as soon as I let go, the joy welled up, and then quickly passed, and I dropped into that better place, which is this quieter, more peaceful happiness, or satisfaction, or contentment, peacefulness. So these are a kind of, you know, it's not easy to attain this. We have our humanness and meeting our fullness. But there is a joy of being human. It's a joy of being on a path of becoming human, path of meeting ourselves. And there's a joy of knowing that you are sharing with many other people a path that is well-tested, well-tried by many people, and that it's a path of honesty, of truth. It's a path of freedom, of allowing your heart to unfold and deepen and find its way. I find a tremendous sense of contentment to know that I have this path of practice to do, that I have the opportunity to be mindful. So even at times when my mindful is hopeless, like I just, you know, my mind is like out of control, and I try to be mindful and I just can't, I'm just so happy I get to try. I feel so lucky that I get to try to do this. I don't get discouraged that easily, because I'd rather be trying and not have it go quick than, you know, go out there and get a job as a used car salesman and, you know, try to make a living that way. I don't know if I want to do that. That's not, you know, I mean, I'm just trying to say, there's all these things, you know, you can do all these things, there's a lot of things you could do out there. Boy, there's a lot of things. Great America, Parkway, Disneyland. But I'd rather be doing this. I'd rather, it's a deeper practice. It goes in. It goes, this is the path in to our humanness, or a depth of who we are. And just to know, even if I feel like I'm not being very successful, so whatever that is, I've learned that even doesn't make sense to say that. There's deep, deep processes going on here. The Dharma knows what needs to happen. You can't know. There's deep, deep things going on. But when I feel kind of conventionally it's not working, I'm just very content I get to try. I get to do it. To do this rather than other things. So the jhanic factors. So now we've reviewed kind of four of them. And the spirit that I like to offer this is that these are ordinary factors of being, that come into play when we use our attention well, when we fully engage wholeheartedly our attention in what we're doing in the moment, whether it's washing dishes, whether it's scrubbing the bathroom floors, whether it's doing the veggie chopping, whether it's washing the pots, or cooking in the kitchen, or taking a shower, or whatever you might be doing. To go and offer yourself wholeheartedly just to that. Give yourself over. Because if you don't offer yourself wholeheartedly to that, what you're doing, I bet your mind has other ideas of what you can be thinking about. And the track record probably is that some of those things are not that great. Not that nourishing. Sometimes they are. So here, the practice wholeheartedly to be whatever you're doing. And if you're sitting in the hall, wholeheartedly kind of be here. And if you're walking, wholeheartedly somehow. So these five jhanic factors are the factors of wholeheartedness. So the making contact, staying there a little bit or a lot, start having some sense of well-being, to defined by the tradition as joy and happiness. And knowing that that's part of the territory, maybe you can kind of feel your way and maybe recognize hints of these or recognize them when they're there. Or if you've underappreciated their value of well-being before, maybe now you can feel more of the value when it starts feeling little hints of it coming up, and make space for it. Relax into it, allow for it. Don't try to hold on to it, don't push it and, you know, try to pump it up or something. But it's more like, you know, open to it and trust. Open to it and trust and allow it to be there. Be quiet and be still. Be careful with it. Be tender with it. It's a tender thing, gentle thing. So four jhanic factors, four factors of wholeheartedness. And so one day, 1,000 years from now, someone will make a sculpture of you in your full humanness, old, bent over, wrinkled, bad eyes, hard of hearing, face all kind of, and they'll say, look, someone who became fully human and free, just as you are. You get to be who you are, just as you are. So, thank you. Let's take a couple of minutes or two to sit. And